Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies of the present and the future scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. This is once again the navigator, John Lash, recording on the 16th of March, 2014, Nav Briefing Number 116, The Omen of War. I'd like to open this briefing by reading a passage from an extraordinary book called Aztec Thought and Culture by Miguel Leon Portilla, spelled L-E-O-N hyphen P-O-R-T-I-L-L-A. Miguel Leon Portilla was an extraordinary scholar and researcher of Aztec and Maya lore. And his book, Aztec Thought and Culture, as far as I'm concerned, which is subtitled, by the way, A Study of the Ancient Nahuatl Mind, is, as far as I am concerned, one of the paramount studies in that very arcane and difficult area of anthropology and mythology. So Miguel Leon Portilla wrote a number of books. I don't know how many of them are now available. My copy of Aztec Thought and Culture was published by the University of Oklahoma Press in Norman, Oklahoma, in 1963. And it comprises one of the treasures in the treasure chest of the Ambergane Trust Library and Archives, which may be considered as a kind of time capsule containing documents and research that would be discovered in the future. You know what a time capsule is. Things are buried in a time capsule with the intention that the capsule would be open in some far future date for the benefit of the people of that time, that they could understand how the people who deposited the time capsule lived and what they knew and what they believed. The treasure chest on the Ark of the Goatfish is a kind of time capsule, but it's a different kind of time capsule because it is a time capsule of the future planted in the present moment rather than a time capsule buried in the present moment with the intention of being discovered and opened in the future. So I'd like to open this briefing by reading this passage from page 122 of Aztec Thought and Culture. Quote, "The suggestion that the deity amuses himself in this way provides a glimpse of what could be called the ultimate reason for his creative activity. The highest level of Nahuatl thought envisions Ometeotl creating and finding pleasure in the mortal's transitory stay on Chaltipac. The mystico-militaristic approach, characteristic of Aztec religion, was entirely different, for here it was felt that the purpose of man's creation was to provide blood for the maintenance of the sun's life. The wise man's interpretation of the creation perhaps held more meaning than might be supposed. Since it was impossible for man on Chaltipac to know the underlying motive for creation, the wise man attributed to it the divine's wish for a spectacle, for entertainment, a play which human beings would perform in a world of dreams. In any case, this idea should be considered another example of, quote, flower and song, end quote, the only way to the many mysteries of what is beyond. And the beyond in Maya and Aztec thought was called Topan or Mictlan, end quote. Also, I would add that in the same passage, the writer quotes a Nahuatl poet. Now, Nahuatl, which obviously is closely related to the word Nahual, is the name for the language of the indigenous peoples of Mexico. Did you know that? They spoke Nahuatl, N-A-H-U-A-T-L. And another thing you may not know, but it would be your pleasure to discover, is that the extremely violent and militaristic or warrior society, war-oriented society of the Aztecs was also extremely aesthetic. And Aztec society, in addition to the apparent insanity and violence of their warrior codes and of the warrior shamanic cults, such as the cult of the jaguar and the eagle, in addition to that, there was evidenced in Aztec culture, or I should say, to avoid the passive voice, in addition to that, Aztec culture evidenced a high aesthetic sophistication. They loved flowers. Imagine warriors who love flowers. The wars that they conducted had not only the purpose of actual conquest and dominance of their tribal adversaries and their tribal competitors, but their wars were also called flower wars. They were, in a way, ritual entertainments of the warrior class. Get that? Okay? And so, Leon Portilla demonstrates magnificently in this book, and I have seen no other book that comes close to doing this, that while we may dismiss and condemn the Aztecs on one hand as being cannibals, which they were, and as having this obsession with war purportedly to provide blood for the maintenance of the sun, at the same time, in the way they lived in their own skins, if they were not flayed skins, and the way they lived moment to moment in their own culture, the Aztecs celebrated the beauty and transience of life in a manner that can only be compared to the Japanese samurai, who were in fact their exact chronological contemporaries. So you find the rise of the Aztec cult of war and, shall I say, flower power at the very same historical moment as the rise of the cult of chivalry in Europe and the rise of the cult of the samurai in Japan. This is an absolutely astounding historical, global, planetary synchronicity. Now, not to get too far away from the point of this citation, let me bring you back to it in this way. Leon Portilla cites some lines from a Nahuatl poet, because the Aztecs were really into poetry and into erotic poetry celebrating the beauty of nature and the transience of human life. Remind you of haiku? And so he cites three lines from a Nahuatl poet. And the source of this citation is a rare manuscript called Cantares Mexicanos, specifically Folio 17, Section X. Quote, It is not true. It is not true that we came to live here. We came only to sleep, only to dream. End quote. Okay. Now, while I am on this riff, while Zag is on this jag, and while the Navigator is on this theme, he proposes to you that post-reset reading in 2014, post-reset reading and study would begin with watching Apocalypto by Mel Gibson. Now, isn't it funny that in the last briefing, isn't it odd? I mean, don't you consider it to be odd? You know, certain things in the world are very odd. For instance, one observer made the point, well, isn't it odd of God to have chosen the Jews? You know, that's very odd. So, isn't it odd, but perhaps delightfully more enlightening, that I ended the last briefing with a kind of cinematic cameo indicating script direction for how to film the crucifixion of the actor who portrays Christ? I'm talking about the real crucifixion of the actor, not the pretended crucifixion of the character played by the actor. Oh, oh, how far can you go with that distinction? Anyway, Mel Gibson, who is in a way an actor who perhaps has represented, you could say, the supreme exemplification of morbido in certain of his films, such as Lethal Weapon, is a morbid, sick, demented Catholic who did the film called The Passion of Christ. And of course, in Mel Gibson's version, now Mel Gibson is a goy, and he's very, you know, he's very deliberate and explicit about the fact that he's a goy and that he's not a Jew in the Hollywood Jew scene, okay? So, it's remarkable that Mel Gibson, who is a horribly demented Catholic, would make the film The Passion of Christ, which is not the version of the film that I ended the last briefing with, is it? So, in Mel Gibson's version, which I haven't seen and which I do not care to watch, I can safely presume that the savior figure actor nailed to the cross, first of all, was not really nailed to the cross because he was merely an actor and it's all a big game of pretending. But secondly, I can assume that that actor in Mel Gibson's version of the crucifixion looked down upon his murderers and torturers with compassion and forgiveness. But isn't it odd that the same person who made that film made Apocalypto? Now, if you haven't seen Apocalypto, I would strongly recommend it. And I would say that two films that are essential to the education of the human animal in the 20th and 21st century are Coppola's Apocalypse Now, with allusions to the Grail and to the book by Jesse Weston on the Grail, and Apocalypto by Mel Gibson. And I have to say that even wretched creatures like Mel Gibson can sometimes transcend themselves. He's no example of sacred manhood to me. He's no example of the hero, but he did the film Braveheart. And there is morbido displayed in Braveheart in a most vivid and spectacular fashion, isn't there? So here you go. I mean, you can't pick and choose who's going to exemplify these things, these paramount qualities of the Anthropos? We can't pick and choose who's going to exemplify them and how. Well, we just take what we can get, you know. So Mel Gibson's Apocalypto was a brilliant depiction of the situation in Central America during the Maya and Aztec, during the apotheosis of the Maya-Aztec psychosis. And it was a psychosis. Okay? So, may I suggest to you, as an exercise of transition and continuity from the GNE, which is confined to the 3 years of reset, into correction, which goes on for 202 years, may I suggest to you that you see Apocalypto and that you read the following five books. They are Aztec Thought and Culture by Miguel Leon Portilla, Popol Vuh by Dennis Tedlock, the greatest living Mayanist scholar who works very closely in teamwork with his female counterpart, The Fifth Sun by Burt Cartwright Brundage, Brundage, and he was a professor at the University of Texas, so his books are published by the University of Texas Press in Austin, Texas. Finally, not finally, quite finally, The Conquest of Mexico by Hugh Thomas, and Burning Water by Laurette Séjourné, Séjourné. And finally, two other books, The Conquest of Mexico by Bernal Diaz, Diaz, who was a Spanish Franciscan, I believe, a Spanish Franciscan or Dominican monk who recorded the conquest of Mexico almost firsthand by Cortes and his band of syphilitic Spaniards from Extremadura. And finally, really finally, The Broken Spears by Miguel Leon Portilla, subtitled The Aztec Account of the Conquest of Mexico. Now get that. Hold on just for a second. The document of Bernal Diaz is the Spanish account of the conquest of Mexico. But get this, and get this distinction. The Broken Spears by Leon Portilla gives the Aztec account of the conquest of Mexico. And that book, remarkably, cites directly those Aztec documents describing the reaction of the Aztecs to the Spanish. In particular, they go into great detail describing how Montezuma behaved following upon the divinations of his sorcerers and court advisors, which were intended to help him interpret the arrival of these alien white creatures into his territory in the valley of Mexico, the massive swamp of the city of Tenochtitlan, which lays below the twin peaks of Popocatépetl and Ixtapalotl, twin volcanic mountains. Now, be very clear on what I am proposing to you. I'm proposing to you that if you wish, if you so desire, and if you might enjoy it, and find it to your edification, that you would enter into the study of the phenomenon of Aztec culture, Aztec, and the destruction of that culture and its conquest by the Spanish. As preparatory studies for correction. I'm not going to explain to you now why I'm proposing that particular inroad to correction. Maybe it'll become obvious later on. Maybe it will never become obvious. But in making that proposal, I'd like to assure you of something that you may not already know. And I say this with total certitude and total confidence. No scholar and no teacher of any spiritual tradition that I know of upon this planet has ever explained what the frack was happening with the Aztecs. The Aztecs themselves couldn't even explain where they came from. They couldn't. They said that they came from a mysterious land, right? You know what it's called, don't you? Go look up the name. And they said that they arrived by wandering. They were hungry and starved and crazed and out of their minds. Some refugee tribe, perhaps fleeing from some global catastrophe, who knows what. They arrived in the Valley of Mexico at the Lake of Mexcoco, which is a swamp, which is where Mexico City now stands, one of the most hideous pustules on the face of the earth. And when they arrived there, they saw an omen. And that omen was an eagle with a snake in its beak perched on a copal tree. Now, what does that mean? Well, I've tried to penetrate that mythological item several times in my life, and it's not an easy thing to do. But I am certain that that image of an eagle holding a serpent in its beak, a live serpent, perched in the boughs of a copal tree, which is the origin image of Aztec civilization, would be, in telestic investigations of the memory banks of the earth, equivalent to a key that you insert in a lock that opens the hologramic memory banks of Aztec and Mayan civilization. And I would love to open those memory banks, which I call conicles, C-O-N-A-C-L-E-S. Actually, I have wandered in those memory banks. I have done that. Indeed, I have. I have bilocated on Infinity Ridge in such a manner that my body and mind and physical presence and human appearance, such as you would encounter, remained standing next to the Devi tree on Infinity Ridge at the same time that my double went into the memory banks, which are the most deeply occluded areas of the memory of the Aeon Sophia. I can't explain to you now why they are, but I can guarantee you that they are deeply occluded, deeply inaccessible areas of her memory of the experiences of the human animal in this experiment. Because she remembers everything that we've done. She records everything that we've done in her second attention. Well, of course she does. Her second attention operates exactly like yours. I've told you that your memory is just the replay button on your second attention. So when you remember what you did as a child of the age of 14, when you remember going to the first day to going to high school, you remember that, what are you doing? You're pushing the replay button of your second attention, and you're imagining that event as it happened at that moment, which is memory, which is nothing but a subfunction or subsidiary function of imagination. Okay. Well, these conicles, which I have investigated, contain some really mind-boggling scenarios, let me tell you. And I went into the conicles or the memory banks specifically pertinent to Maya and Aztec civilization prior to the conquest of Mexico by Cortez, rather in the way that someone would wander into the stacks of the Library of Congress or any other great library in the United States. And I did this in an ecstatic telestic trance. Well, I just walked through the stacks and I looked at various sections of the library and saw the labels on those sections, which are written in a scroll-like fashion, as you see the scrolls depicted in Maya and Aztec bas-relief. You see a Maya shaman with a scroll coming out of its mouth, which is like the balloon of a cartoon illustration, right? Well, I wandered among these stacks in the conicals of the planetary memory of the Aeons of Fire, but I didn't really stop and take out any of the inserts in those conicals so that I could examine them and read them in depth. So I'm here to tell you that I would invite you along with me into a deep study of what in the frack was going on in these incredibly deep and mysterious and, in some respect, psychotically insane indigenous cultures of Mexico prior to 1520. Now, why is that investigation relevant? Why does that investigation, which you might pursue by reading these books, how many of them are there? I can't even remember. Five, six? I don't know. My short-term memory of what I did 5 minutes ago is really shot. I can't remember where my socks are 3 minutes after I take them off. This is where it's gotten with me due to the extreme and extravagant degree of concentration required to maintain the GNE. Can you see that? So I don't know how many books I cited. In any case, try them out, whatever you're attracted to. When I'm proposing this investigation, for those of you who have the intention to go forward as Calico warriors from reset into correction. And I can guarantee you with complete certitude that no scholar has ever figured out what that whole thing was about. You will note, if you read Bernal Diaz, the Spanish witness to the conquest from the viewpoint of the Spanish, i.e. Christian, i.e. Judeo-Christian salvationist mindset, if you read his testimony, you will see that he says repeatedly, again and again, that Cortez and his syphilitic band of gangsters entered Tenochtitlan in an altered state. They continually remarked among themselves that they felt like they were in a dream. This is on record. This is written. Bernal Diaz says, he quotes them. This is almost as good as firsthand. And he says, as they marched into the city of Tenochtitlan, which was gloriously beautiful with its gardens and its lakes, that they couldn't believe what they were seeing, that they had the strong and overwhelming impression that they were actually in a dream. And well, may I quote the Nahuatl poet once again. It is not true. It is not true that we came to live here. We came only to sleep, only to dream. So what am I getting at here? Well, I think it's pretty obvious, isn't it? The passage I quote from Leon Portilla is a clear and unambiguous statement of the oniric theory of creation. Now, we in Planetary Tantra, in the GNE, are in the habit of associating the oniric theory, that is to say, we live in the dream of aeons, we live in the dream of superhuman and supernatural beings, to be a standard reference for what we do. Okay? We routinely refer to the Hindu metaphor of Vishnu dreaming. But we know that it's not a metaphor. Hey, it's not a metaphor. Who's talking to you now? Whose voice are you listening to on this recording? Well, it is the voice of a human animal named John Lash, right? Because other human animals with other names have the habit of calling me that. Period. When people ran into me and they might have known me as a writer, I used to respond when they said, "Oh, are you John Lash?" I'd say, "Yeah, some people call me that." So some people call me John Lash, but what am I, really? I am what the people who call me John Lash are. Fictions and characters in a dream. Do you get that? Now, this oniric conception of reality is to me delightful, voracious, and we're in the process of finding out how to practice it, how to make it work. Well, it so happens that Leon Portilla shows that the Aztec culture was deeply immersed in that same conception of eonic or oniric reality, okay? Oniric reality, that is, life is nothing but a dream of the higher dreaming entity. That dreaming entity is called, in Aztec philosophy, Ometeotl. Ometeotl. Great. Now, much to the credit of the Aztecs, they did not conceive Ometeotl as a singular male deity. They conceived Ometeotl as a divine pairing of a male and female divinity. That's even better than the Hindus, because the Hindus say that it's Vishnu who's dreaming you and me as characters. You're the character with a such and such a name that gives me the name of John Lash as fictional personalities in this dreaming, okay? Well, the Aztecs did even better. They didn't confine it to Vishnu as a single male dreaming divinity. Now, the word for the earth or the setting or scene of this dreaming activity as it is experienced by human animals is Tlaltikpak. 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 Tlaltikpak was their name for the setting of this dream, which is the earth, the planet earth. Remember that the Gnostic teaching is the teaching not of the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, certainly included that, but primarily the teaching of the three S's, that the Aeon Sophia is the source of the human experiment, she is the setting of the human experiment, and she is as well, or to be precise, her biography is the story of the human experiment. That is to say, that her story is the correct framework for human animals to understand the human experiment. So, according to Leon Portilla, writes here very interestingly that, quote, since it was impossible for man on Tlaltikpak, that is the earth, to know the underlying motive for creation, the wise men of the Aztecs attributed that motive to the divine's wish for a spectacle, for entertainment. Well, come on. Hey, I'm a comparative mythologist, and now so are you. What does a comparative mythologist do? Compares the outstanding, prevalent, persistent themes that resonate in different and diverse mythologies. So, the Sanskrit notion that the worlds are simply a display of play, lila, L-I-L-A in Sanskrit, to entertain the eons, is echoed and reflected and repeated precisely in this Aztec conception, isn't it? Okay, so far so good. Before proceeding, I want to make a slight correction. It was not a copal tree, but a nopal cactus. Okay? There is an image in the Codex Borgia, one of the half a dozen or so late codices that survive from the Spanish conquest of Mexico, depicting in the style of that time the eagle perched upon the nopal cactus with a serpent in its beak. And this was the omen recorded by the Aztec peoples, who were known to the Toltecs who received them as the Chichimec, meaning the dog peoples. They called them dogs for two reasons. One is because the language of the Aztecs to the Toltec ear was like the yapping of dogs. Because the Toltecs, who had preceded them in the Valley of Mexico and founded their civilization at Teotihuacan, received these bizarre visitors with some alarm because of the bestiality, as it were, of their behavior. They were like yapping dogs in their language. And the second reason being that they were cannibals. So they knew, the Toltecs knew that dogs eat human flesh. The Toltecs were not cannibals. Get it? The Aztecs were cannibals. And so they called them the Chichimecs, or the dog people. So when the dog people came to the Valley of Mexico, they saw this omen. That was the omen of the foundation of Aztec civilization. Now, the rise of Aztec civilization over about, let's say, 1350, about less than 250 years, and their supposed conquest or domination of the Toltecs is a completely inexplicable event. Now, if you go and read Twins in the Double, you'll find my interpretation of the story of the magical or shamanic the contest between Quetzalcoatl and Tezcatlipoca. Now, unfortunately, people who do not know what the frack they're talking about have interpreted this whole episode in an entirely erroneous fashion. They have claimed that Quetzalcoatl is in some respect a benevolent or good guy, benevolent figure or good guy, and Tezcatlipoca is the bad guy. Now, I take that remark very personally, I have to tell you. And I can assure you that that is utterly wrong, and that the Toltec sorcerer Tezcatlipoca, whose name means Lord of the Smoking Mirror, was not by any means what he has been scripted to be in later interpretations of this event. Now, if you read the account of the conquest of Mexico written by Hugh Thomas, which stands far and above any other modern account, you can find in there the name of who was truly the evil sorcerer of the Aztecs. And that is the name of a shaman and sorcerer who was an advisor to Moctezuma. And Hugh Thomas explains, go find the name of this character, okay? And Hugh Thomas explains that this character destroyed and burned all of the history of the Aztecs and the remaining history of the Toltecs and rewrote the books. Does that sound familiar to you? Someone who destroys the true record of the history of a people and rewrites that in the form of a narrative lie. Well, this is actually what the evil advisor of Moctezuma did regarding to the previous history of the Aztecs and to their relation to the Toltecs. Okay? So the fact is, no historian and no scholar knows anything about it. And much of the information that they derive is erroneous because it was rewritten according to the agenda of this sorcerer who was intimately involved in betraying the Aztec emperor Moctezuma, whom he was supposed to serve. This is a dirty story of betrayal in the royal courts. Now, why am I bringing up all this infinite and arcane material about the Aztecs right now? Well, it's 6:28 a.m. in the morning here in Andalusia. And given that the sky is clear, as it often is, I can confidently step away from this computer, take off these headphones, walk out and stand on the upper terrace of my house, and behold the glorious vision of Venus Lucifer, the morning star. And Venus Lucifer is now situated in the constellation of the Makara, or goatfish, the constellation that represents the totality of the forces of Kali Ma herself, the mysterious power of Kali Ma, is in some manner embodied or encoded in the image of the goatfish. And that constellation in the Hindu zodiac is called Makara, meaning crocodile. The proper way to depict the constellation of the goatfish is to show the forepart of the figure with the graceful body of a gazelle and two horns, and four legs of a gazelle, as if the gazelle were leaping. But the other part of the body of the animal is the tail of a fish curled as if into a spiral, which is also reminiscent of a cornucopia. This complex image becomes complete when you add the ark, the treasure chest that you see positioned on the back of the goatfish. As you may know, the cover image of my book, Quest for the Zodiac, is a photograph of an alabaster sculpture that used to be in the Boulak Museum in Cairo that depicts this very image. Additionally, there is a young girl, a woman, sitting with her back to the Ark of the Goatfish, sitting comfortably behind the prow, the beautiful and graceful prow marked by the figurehead of the gazelle, which is a form of a goat, and she holds to her breast an open lotus flower. As I go out on my porch this evening and I stand there and watch Venus rising against the velvet blackness of the sky, this is what I picture. Doing so, I combine or merge the activity of my first attention, the power of observation, with the activity of my second attention, the power to visualize or imagine. And I see both things simultaneously. I see the actual shining orb of the planet Venus, like a diamond on black velvet, and I picture its position corresponding to the lotus of the heart. The lotus of the heart is the secret of the future of humanity and of Anthropos 11. And that is the subject of Nav Briefing number 118, which completes the Gaian navigation experiment. That is to say, it completes the briefings to be given during the 3 years of reset. But hold on, hold on. When I stand there and look at Venus in the morning sky, in the pre-dawn sky, as you may as well do, as you may do as well, Mimedes, I see something else as well. Additional to the symbol, if you will, of the mutation of Anthropos 10 into Anthropos 11, I see an omen of war. Now, you might recall, back in the nav briefings, whenever it was, when I began to talk, when I began to prepare you for the appearance of Venus before dawn in March 2014, you may recall that I related that event to an omen of war, didn't I? Now, I said something which I don't know can be verified or validated by scholars. You might go and research it. I just said something because that's the way I say things, you know. So, I said that the Aztecs observed the rising of Venus in the morning sky after her passage in the underworld called the Xibalba to determine whether they would go to war or not. So they considered her appearance in the morning sky an omen of war. And I said that it was specifically the Aztecs who observed that omen, didn't I? Okay. I stand guilty of making that statement, okay? Now, right now, I can't tell you whether or not that statement comes from something I read in studies of Aztec culture, or whether I just invented it, which is to say that it emerged and erupted spontaneously in the endopsyche of the human animal, and I spoke it. I can't really say. Now, there's an enormous amount of material on the internet about the Aztec and Maya observation of the Venus cycle. I don't propose that you go and look at all of that or any of it because you can get lost in it very quickly. What you might want to look at, just one thing you might want to look at, are the illustrations of the Dresden Codex, because the Dresden Codex contains a record of an ephemeris, actually, of the Venus cycles. And the Dresden Codex also uses a visualization of the constellations, particularly of Perseus and the Bull and the Pleiades. So you will find in the illustrations of the Dresden Codex, which you can investigate online, a cosmic serpent visualized in the area of the Bull and Perseus, a rattlesnake. And it so happens that those who designed that constellation among the ancient sky diviners of Mexico pictured the Pleiades as the rattle of that rattlesnake. Now, since you are fledgling comparative mythologist, I dare you and I invite you to pursue that point of comparative lore. Anyway, it's a beautiful illustration in the Dresden Codex of this rattlesnake, and the tables of Venus, which are astonishingly accurate, in some respects more accurate than current astronomical tables until very recent times, can be found on the pages of the Codex where that image appears. Then you could also read, if you wanted to, all kinds of stuff about the Venus cycle as understood and interpreted among the Aztecs. I strongly suggest that you don't go down that rabbit hole right now. Rather, go to metahistory.org, click on 2012 Shift, and pick the essay entitled The Tablet of Destiny. And there you will find some writings dating back, I would say, to Andalusia, 23 June 2007. And in that essay, you'll find quite a number of comments relevant to the current briefing. Now, although I told, let me remind you that I told my astrological clients many years ago that I never predicted. Now, I've never used astrology to predict. I've also told you, members of the GNE, going into this experiment, that we don't predict, but we anticipate. For us, anticipation is a practice. It's an exercise. We know that in the exercise of anticipation, we are exercising our powers of the second attention. We are learning to track and manifest that which we can only at first imagine. Right? You imagine something to occur, and then you anticipate the moment when it will occur. The secret to our process and our practice in the GNE is that the navigator has been able to provide you with the precise time parameters that allow you to observe the exact results of what you're anticipating, okay? Now, when I said that the Aztecs observed the appearance of Venus in the morning sky as an omen of war, wherever that comes from, and whether or not that is supported by scholarly research, well, what do you say? What do you say about Ukraine? Let me just take a moment and see if I can give you a geopolitical analysis of Ukraine in 3 minutes. Now, I'm not a geopolitical analyst, as you know, but at moments I have ventured into that area as we have followed world events in the timing of the GNE. Here is my geopolitical analysis of Ukraine. Back in September of 2013, in the timing suggesting the emergence of the warrior ethos and the hero and the expression of Mobido, the Russian gangster and politician Vladimir Putin made a checkmate move to the neocon / Zadokite program in the Middle East. It is known from the testimony of Wesley Clark that the neocons of the Bush and Obama administration had a plan to take down 7 or 8 Muslim countries in succession in a domino-like collapse. And that was part of their game plan for the hegemony of the U.S. military powers, who are proxies to Israel, okay? Following 9/11. Vladimir Putin, in one move in September of 2013, stopped them dead in their tracks and foiled the program that they were pursuing in the Middle East, in the heartland of the mysteries, in Syria. Syria, the homeland of the mysteries, Syria and Lebanon. Well, needless to say, the powers that were pursuing that agenda for their nefarious reasons, which include looting and pillaging and oil and all those dirty deals, as well as a higher ideological psychosis about domination of the human race, according to the Zadokite Talmudic agenda, were really pissed and really thwarted. That was back in September, remember? So what happens? One member of that cabal, whose name is known, decided to undertake a certain activity as a payback, not a payback, as a retaliation to Vladimir Putin. And that member, whose name is known, we know the names of the cabal of the planetary psychopaths, some of the names, some we will never know. That one, whose name is known, has enough money to dish out more than $1 billion in order to foment a false revolution in a country. And he had already done that a number of times. And these revolutions fomented by this globalist monster were called color revolutions. And in fact, he fomented a revolution in Ukraine some years ago. It was called the Orange Revolution. Of course, a geopolitical analyst, which I am not, could tell you that these revolutions are not revolutions at all coming from the people of the place, but they are theatrical events staged under the pretext of bringing democracy to a country. But in fact, they are really operations to loot and destroy that country, to hijack all of its resources, and to destroy the identity of the population. So that's the truth about these events and how they really happen and who's behind them, by contrast to the official narrative or the mainstream narrative, which is a complete lie and distraction. Unfortunately, simply knowing the truth about what is happening in these events itself is not enough to change those events, is it? It changes the perception of those events among those who see the truth and accept it, but still, those who see what's really happening cannot necessarily affect what's happening merely by knowing the truth. This is the tragic truth about truth pertaining to the human situation, as I've said. Well, it so happens now that this individual, whose name is George Soros, wanted to prove to himself and those lackeys and psychopaths and accessory psychopaths who suck up to him and drive his cars and manicure his nails and do his paperwork for him. He wanted to show all of them and the world at large what a big guy he is and how he can actually strike back at Vladimir Putin in such a way as to cause enormous grief and death and chaos in the life of the Russian people, and particularly Ukrainians. And in doing so, said creature, George Soros, shows a certain knowledge of Russian history, because he hits back at Putin in that area of Russia that is most deeply wounded, Ukraine. Go and read about what happened in Ukraine. Go and read about the Holodomor, the Ukrainian Holocaust, which really did happen and which really did kill millions of people, contrary to the legend of the Jewish Holocaust. Go and read about the massacre in the Katyn Forest that was committed by the Jewish Bolsheviks and blamed on the Nazis. Now, what is happening in the Ukraine is horrific by any standards, but it is particularly horrific when you realize that the potential for world war erupting from this place is supercharged with suffering, is supercharged with the anguish and confusion of human suffering, because the Ukraine, or Ukraine, is the location of the deepest wound inflicted upon the Russian people in the underbelly of the Russian nation. Soros certainly knows that he strikes back at Putin in that area, and his intention is clearly to reopen that wound and to reinfect that wound with hatred, duplicity, confusion, chaos, violence, and division. And he's doing a really good job of it. Well, why shouldn't he? He has the money to pay for the teams that can do it. I saw a clip on YouTube, which could be false. I don't believe anything I see on the internet. But I saw a clip on YouTube that purported to be an interview with an agent provocateur in the Ukraine situation who said that he was paid $1 million to do what he did. Okay, if this is true, there you have it. Here is the truth. Now you know the truth. But it doesn't matter just to know the truth, does it? Anyway, to complete my geopolitical analysis here, I would say that George Soros is, or allows himself to be, a publicly identified figure. He just received some kind of freedom award. Can you imagine this? He received a freedom award at the very moment that his agents provocateurs are performing their nefarious activities in Ukraine. And George Soros is the victim of the psychopathic ego of a monumental nature. And he loves to be recognized for what he does, so let's totally recognize him for what he really does. So let's just pick this name because it's a cheap shot, it's an easy shot. And let me use the name of George Soros to return to the theme of the previous briefing, namely, who teaches you to hate and how you can be taught to hate in the correct manner. It's commonly and conventionally known that all religions contain trilogies or trinities, you know. This Trinitarian formula occurs in many variations in many religions. So you have Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. That's the Trinity of Christian religion. Now I propose to you that Planetary Tantra, which is not a religion, but an alternative to all religions, also has its own trinity. But it's an ethical trinity rather than a theological trinity. What is the ethical trinity of Planetary Tantra to be adopted by Calico warriors in correction? It is the trinity formed by the integrity of love, freedom, and truth. That is your trinity. Love, freedom, and truth. Now, just going to take the factor of love out of that trinity for a moment. And I'll remind you that on the wheel of compassion, love is located opposite to indifference. And they are complementary. Now, I would ask you this. Knowing the name of George Soros as an identified perpetrator of global evil, many people would recognize him as such, and other names quickly come to mind. But just taking Soros, knowing that name, I would ask you, what behavior would you express to him? Were you in his presence? Were you in a position to affect him? You know the truth about what he does, but you're not in a position to act on that truth because you can't get to George Soros. Suppose you could. Would you show him love or would you show him indifference? Hold that question in mind for a moment. Now I'm going to go to two other spokes of the Wheel of Compassion. Hate is a point on the rim of the wheel, and opposite that point is generosity. The opposite of hate, which I propose to teach you, the true and correct expression of hate, correctly targeted by elucidated anger, that force, that moral virtue of hate, is not opposite to love, but opposite to generosity. So I ask you again, were you to be in physical contact, an access to a perpetrator like George Soros, how would you behave toward him? Would you manifest generosity, or would you manifest hate? You see, the first step, the first orientation to the warrior ethics of planetary tantra is that you got to know what your options are when you're face to face with the perpetrators. Now, that perpetrator could be George Soros, if he wasn't surrounded by miles and miles of security and people that he pays untold sums of money to protect him. Or it could be the local pedophile, or it could be someone in your family or in your community who is doing harm in some way, harming children, harming animals, using duplicity and deceit to harm the fabric of social relationships. It doesn't matter if it's the predator down the block, the predator in your family constellation, or George Soros. The same options are always in play. Go back to the wheel of compassion and choose your option from the rim. Would you face George Soros, knowing what he does, knowing the truth about what he does, knowing the inconceivable harm and horror that he is able to engender in this world because of power and money? Would you face him and act upon him with love or indifference? With hate or generosity? You must always consider these options in pairs. You only have a choice when you have two things. When there's only one thing, is no choice. If I said to you, if you met George Soros or Tony Blair or some other obvious, you know, blatant, flagrant, high-profile global predator, would you express love to them or not? That's not a good question. That's not a good Calico strategy. Don't put yourself in that strategy because you don't have a choice. It's a yes or no question. But if I say, would you meet them with love or generosity, love or indifference, then you've got a choice. And if you choose to meet them with indifference, then you've got a strategic position and you can do a lot of things toward that individual out of pure indifference. Because indifference is a valuable moral and ethical response, as good as love. I wouldn't show indifference to George Soros, however, because I only show indifference to people whose actions I would tolerate. Now, you know, I don't approve of certain actions. You know that, don't you? But some of them I tolerate. I show indifference toward the people who conduct those actions as long as they do not conduct them in a way that I find objectionable because it causes harm to others or because it is a performance of duplicity and deceit. So now you know what tolerance is, real tolerance. It is the practice of indifference, which is the perfect complement to love. It's a form of love to tolerate. But I don't tolerate George Soros, so I'm not going to show him either love or indifference. Well, let's look at the other two options. We're only looking at 4 out of 6 here. I can show him hate or generosity. Why is generosity the opposite of hate? Very simple, because the natural disposition of the human animal, such as myself and yourself, is to be generous. And I make huge mistakes with my generosity, believe me. Learning how to handle your generosity is already a great practice in itself. And I can tell you, believe me, I have handled my generosity very badly, and I've made a lot of mistakes in the past with my generosity, and I mean materially speaking, and in other respects as well, with my emotional generosity, with my intellectual generosity. But I'm not forced to be generous to anybody. You can get a lot out of contemplating the complementarity of generosity and hate. Because in doing so, you'll find yourself looking again and again at this question. Since generosity is my essential nature, since I am fundamentally a generous person, if you want to put it in those terms, there would have to be special conditions at play for me to withhold my generosity. So, on what occasion do I withhold my generosity? Well, I withhold it from people who are not worthy of it, right? Well, why are they not worthy of my generosity? Because they're doing things that I perceive to be hate-worthy, and things that I hate them for doing. One of the things I teach you regarding how to hate is that I would never tell you or teach you to hate any particular group of people, be it the Irish or the Jews or the Argentinians, or any specified individual in those groups, unless I indicated the behavior of that individual that needs to be hated. It needs to be hated. You need to hate. It's a need in the human animal. But you need to hate with clarity and sobriety. What George Soros does needs to be hated. And he, as a person who does it, needs to be hated. Now, I can't say that I hate him personally, because I don't know him personally. But I hate what he's doing. And by extension, I hate him for doing it. See that? This is a way to formulate in clear and reasonable terms, in a rational way, that's it. This is a rational formulation of hatred. But I shouldn't use the word hatred, because I'm going to reserve the word hatred for the irrational expression of hate. So this is the teaching, this is the distinction at the beginning of the teaching. Hatred is an irrational expression of hate. But the challenge of hate for the human animal is to learn to hate rationally. And that means to know who to hate and why. And then when you know that, to know what to do to that individual, if you can get to them. And it's all about individuals. It's really, really personal. But it's not. I don't personally hate George Soros. You can say I hate him transpersonally, if you want to put that spin on it. But because he is a human person, and I am as well, then I guess at the end of the day, you'd have to say, I hate that person for what he does, and I hate him for doing it. And this is what you need to do in every single instance, one person at a time, one situation at a time, as you hone and define your capacity to hate. At this moment, at the beginning of the formulation of Gaian ethics, I can confidently say that the human animal, if it is a sane and rational animal, has the need to hate in it. and the need to hate ought to be included in the Maslowian hierarchy of needs. How's that one for you? You need to hate because hate protects what you love. It is one way to protect what you love. You need to hate that which threatens or harms what you love. And if what you love is the planet Earth and nature and all non-human life and the anthropos and humankind and children, then you need hate to protect all of that. You need the hate of those who would harm that to defeat them from harming it. And that is such, and that is an unavoidable and unnegotiable truth of human reality. Rajneesh said it so many years ago, all those years ago. Everything that you have been taught about love corrupts and undermines the authenticity of love, corrupts and undermines your genuine capacity for love. And that damage is so vast that it's a fucking miracle that any of us can even genuinely love at all. But love did not get us into this problem on this planet, my friends, and love is not going to get us out. Anyone that tells you that love is a force that can change or affect or impact the psychotic, murderous deceivers operating on this planet is telling you a lie. Or to be kind about it, they're contaminating you with a pernicious act of make-believe. You can make-believe it so that love is going to save the world and change it to the better. But you show me one single instance in which that has done when the love was applied to those who are harming and destroying this world. It has never happened. So the final thing I want to say, as I stand here in the dawn now, with Venus in the light of the morning sky shining high above my terrace, is that you can now prepare to embrace in your life and in your mind the combination of ethics and tactics that are required to turn this world around in correction. Even though the Aeon Sophia has set the initial conditions for her correction, it cannot succeed without a measure of human participation. From this moment on, I invite you to live as I do and to live every day. At some moment of the day, don't get obsessed with it. Don't get buried in it. Don't forget to enjoy yourself. Don't make it more important than the delight and wonder of the moment. Don't lose the delight and the gratitude of merely being alive. But take some time in your life every day and consider how we contribute the measure of participation. And I tell you that the two devices to engage us in her correction, existentially and morally, are ethics and tactics. So I spoke in the beginning of this briefing about the Bhagavad Gita and the teaching of Krishna to Arjuna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. That is the mythological and historical moment from which arises the ethics of planetary tantra and the Kalika War Party. But as for the tactics of that party, the tactics of war, they arise from the Aztec Maya complex. Did you ever think about that? Did you ever think that you would hear me say anything like that? I would not direct your attention and the precious time in which you live to a consideration of such an arcane and difficult area of history if it were not absolutely essential. The shamanic tactics of war to be enacted against the predators on the planetary scale derive from an understanding of the warrior shamanism of the Aztecs. That is my view. And so in the coming months, as I present now and then talks on the Calico War Party and talks for the War Party, powwows for the warriors, I intend to do my best to elucidate that powerful and daunting and mysterious proposition. Thus spoke Tezcatlipoca.